This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. The state is due to present more details on how to fix funding inequities among school districts at a hearing today in the Leandro case. Governor Mike Easley has come up with $22 million, and that leaves the state about $200 million short of meeting the goals set out in the Leandro plan. Other issues of interest around North Carolina include the Chapel Hill Town Council's vote to change Airport Road to Martin Luther King Boulevard, the acceleration of outsourcing blue and white-collar jobs overseas, and the state's increasing immigrant population. We'll discuss these topics and many, many more in our roundtable today. Mike Munger is here, chair of Duke University's Political Science Department. Ed Cohn, a columnist for the Greensboro News and Record, and WUNC's Capitol reporter Laura Leslie, all here with us today. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks.
Thanks to be here.
Thanks.
Welcome your calls as well at 877-962-9862. We think we know what we're going to talk about. You might want to talk about something else or these topics as well. 877-962-9862. Join in on the roundtable today as we talk about what's going on in the state on the state of things. Laura, let's talk about the Leandro case first. There's a hearing today. We're going to get some details about it. Why don't we go give us a little background on the Leandro case?
Well, the Leandro case started, I think, in 1994, but the ruling actually came down in 1997. And basically, it was a ruling that the state has is constitutionally bound to provide a sound basic education equally to all of its students, whether or not they live in low wealth school districts or high wealth.
And so we used to call those poor.
Right. Okay. Well, politically correctly, it's a low wealth school district. But but anyway, the end result is the same, that the state has to come up with money to help these school districts to give kids the same access to a good education. The problem, of course, is coming up with the money. The governor's been in on it. The courts have been in on it. The legislature has been suspiciously silent on it and actually removed some funding in last year's budget that the governor had put in for Leandro. So what the judge is likely to do today is to call the legislature to account and to start asking some questions about what's going to happen next year in the budget.
Well, tell me a little bit about that process. You say call the legislature to account. What's the judge's role in this, and what can he do beyond calling to account?
Well, he can find the state in contempt. He can Well, that's a really good question. I'm not sure what he can do except for make a lot of noise about it. But, you know, there's a lot of people who are very, very interested in this. It's a hot sort of topic, politically speaking, as well as socially.
Well, tell me about what's going on in the State House. As you said, the legislature walked away from it. They passed a $15 billion budget, not a nickel for this. The plan would call for about $220 million in spending. Governor came up with $22. So that leaves him pretty short. Are there advocates in the State House for executing this plan?
There are very strong advocates in the State House. But as you know, what happens behind closed doors in budget committee meetings is not something that's open to the public in this state. So it's difficult to know what sort of arguments took place in those committee meetings. But what we have is what they came out of the room with, and that is a budget with no money for Leandro. But it is important to remember that Manning has not set a figure that
this
the state
is Judge
has,
Howard Manning.
Right. Judge Manning has not come up with a figure. He's saying it's not about money, it's about access. The state has to figure out how much money that's going to cost.
But they've been through a process. Let me bring Ed Cohn into this discussion and Mike Munger. There has been a process, right? We've gone through a process, Ed, of determining what the need is, what those poor districts are, and how far apart they are, how far they are from the wealthier districts.
And it's not, by the way, the original counties were tended to be rural counties, and the larger urban counties joined in the suit too. So it's not as it originally was, just a few traditionally poor counties trying to get this equal access. It includes the larger urban counties as well. I would just think that the conversation in the State House or in the legislature should look at a similar amount of money that they just gave to Dell to come to the Triad. It's a little bit more than they need for Leandro, and if they could somehow convince the legislators that if you invest the money in education and you give North Carolina a solid public education system, then you won't need to bribe large companies to come here because they'll want to come here.
Well, the Dell package is $242 million, but advocates will argue that's not cash up front. Those are incentives that could pay it over 20 years.
Understood, and I'm all for that package, by the way. We certainly need it here in the Triad. I'm just saying that if we can find ways to finance corporate relocations, we might want to invest in ways that would make us not have to finance future corporate relocations.
Mike Munger, is that conversation happening in the state, or is it just about, well, we don't have the money, we'll have to go back to the drawing board?
Well, the judge, Judge Manning, would like to say that they're playing chicken, and that the legislature is kind of brinksmanship and waiting to see what will happen. The fact is they can always appeal up to the state anything that he is going to try to impose. What's happened in other states is that the judges have ended up writing very specific formulas. In Texas and some other states, basically they've placed the state education system in receivership. And unless our judicial system is willing to at least threaten to do that, I don't think the legislature is going to do anything. There's no reason for them to do it. They can't individually claim credit for it the way that they can claim credit for bringing in new jobs.
Let's just change subjects a little bit and talk about the Chapel Hill Town Council last night that did vote to change Airport Road, the name of the road, to Martin Luther King. The question I have is that Chapel Hill has a reputation of being sort of a liberal, progressive community, but this was quite a fight in that community, and it took them quite a while. Laura?
I was struck by a phrase that I saw in one of the accounts of that meeting in which somebody described the situation in Chapel Hill as negative peace. As a lack of tension, not active pursuit of justice. That was a very, because I think this whole discussion has been really skating on the surface of a lot of topics that a lot of people in Chapel Hill, I think, would rather not discuss, but which do need to be discussed.
Well, Chris Rock, of course, had the best line about this, about the lack of MLK boulevards in white neighborhoods, and that's the true sign of progress. I read something that Chapel Hill Town Councilwoman Sally Green wrote at her or posted at her weblog a while ago, a speech she gave. Her concern about renaming the road was that it wasn't enough. It wasn't doing enough to bring social change and to honor Martin Luther King.
Yeah, but nobody opposed the change for that reason. They were suggesting more, but nobody said.
I was just reminding our listeners that this is happening in Chapel Hill, not in High Point, where they just almost come right out and say why they don't want to do it.
Right.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join our conversation about almost everything in the state today. We're talking about talk with Mike Munger and Ed Cohn and Laura Leslie from WUNC. You know, this also, Ed, brings to mind what's going on in Greensboro. There's a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that's going to look into the Greensboro Massacre, and they really start their work, the public phase of their work, in January.
That's true. They've moved into their offices, which this whole project grew out of a church right off of Martin Luther King Boulevard in Greensboro. And they're moving more into a neighborhood that has streets like Elm, street names like Elm. It's still a controversial subject here in Greensboro. Still doesn't have buy-in from the city elected leadership, but it's happening anyway.
That's an interesting thing. I mean, I suppose it's predictable on the one hand. The elected leadership would like to see this thing just go away. And maybe you should refresh our memory, the Greensboro Massacre in 1979. Talk about what happened and why, if you're one of the city fathers and mothers, you may want to put this past you. On the other hand, if you look at what happened where Truth and Reconciliation Commissions work, it's always good things for the locale, aren't they?
Well, calling it the Greensboro Massacre right away, you're in a political no man's land there, because you're not allowed to do that in some places. As listeners may remember, on November 3rd, 1979, a group of Klansmen and neo-Nazis shot and killed five marchers at a left-wing workers' protest here in Greensboro. And a survivor of that, Nelson Johnson, has been instrumental in organizing a Truth and Reconciliation Commission here in Greensboro to find out what happened, why no criminal charges stuck to the killers, even though they were caught on videotape pulling an arsenal of weapons out of the trunks of their cars and shooting people in broad daylight. I have been involved in this process as sort of a community participant who has said frequently to Nelson Johnson and to people in this group, if this is going to work, you have to tell the whole truth. You have to say it's not just that the white power structure denied us justice in the courts, you have to say, I think, that we didn't cooperate with the prosecution and that civil verdicts were returned against the city of Greensboro and the police department. You should not just say that the Klan and the Nazis showed up one morning. You should point out that it was billed as a death to the Klan rally, and that there was actually personal animosity with Klan members who had been confronted before. In other words, it's a very complex piece of history.
How's it going to work, though? Tell us what exactly how
see. I've been watching it. I'm a little leery of the process. I'm rooting for it, but what I've asked them to do, as a an observer along the way, is to distance the original participants, the survivors, as much as possible from the process, so that it is seen as being an objective search for truth rather than a report written by people who are hired to write it by one side. I've been a little frustrated with the process. It seems to be very in-house to me. The fundraising was done through Nelson Johnson's community organization. And all of this, to me, lends it gives ammunition to the people who just want it to go away because it was a bad thing that happened here.
Let's talk a little bit more about this and immigration and globalization and much, much more on the state of things when our conversation with Mike Munger, Ed Cohn, and Laura Leslie continues. A conversation with you as well, 877-962-9862. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. We're talking about the latest issues from around the state today with Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department at Duke University. Ed Cohn is opinion columnist at the Greensboro News and Record, and Laura Leslie, Capitol reporter here at WUNC. We're taking your calls at 877-962-9862. Ed, before the break, we were talking about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that's going to look into the Greensboro massacre in Greensboro, get underway in January. I did want to find out a little bit more about the process and how much of that is going to take place publicly. In other words, how much is it going to look like what happened in South Africa, for instance, where there were hearings, people came, they made their confessions, they made their observations, and everybody got to hear it.
Well, these folks don't have subpoena power. I should say there is a panel. It has been named. There is oversight or at least advice coming from an international Truth and Reconciliation Commission out of New York that has worked around the world. This is the first one in the United States. So the process, how public it is and how much they're able to get people to cooperate, I think that will be an important part of whether this succeeds or not.
As somebody who's certainly watched that process in Greensboro for a long time, I wonder what your take on this this whole business of perceptions of communities and their race relations. Greensboro has a reputation. Chapel Hill, as we talked about earlier, a progressive reputation. But to what extent do you think this is a little bit unfair, and that the questions that we need to face and deal with, particularly with regard to race relations, are ubiquitous, and perhaps the labels are doing us all a disservice?
Well, I'll just say that I think Greensboro, taken in some sort of historical overview, has a reasonably progressive and positive racial history for a southern city, going back to our Quaker heritage and on through the sit-ins happening here and strong presence of A&T. And at the same time, it's my personal view that if you have a group within your community who is telling you again and again and again, we are unhappy, we feel justice wasn't done, telling them that they should be happy and should just shut up is probably not a very productive way of dealing with the issue, and doesn't really lend to your progressive history.
Well, let's switch topics a little bit and talk about immigration in the state. That's another concern in the State House and around the state. One study says the state's foreign-born population nearly doubled over the past 4 years. We got 2,000 census data that shows more people are coming to North Carolina from Mexico than any other country, about 40% of the incoming population. Enrollment in ESL classes, community college, all that on the rise. Laura, what does it mean?
Well, it means a lot of things. It depends on who you ask. For the immigrants, it depends where they're from. 40% of our immigrants in North Carolina are coming to us from Mexico. And looking overall at all the immigration, 59% of our immigrants and their children are living in or near poverty. And 42% don't have a high school diploma. So, you know, you can kind of look at what that means in terms of living standards and poverty levels in North Carolina. But that's not the whole picture. There's a lot of immigrants, especially coming to us in high-tech industries, for example, who are doing very well. And so I think the state has a lot to think about in terms of how that's going to change the shape of the state's workforce and the population over the next 10 years.
Mike Munger, do we have any indication now about sort of how that's going to change the state?
I grew up in rural Central Florida and went to segregated schools, and people were always unwilling to talk about the fact that we had racial problems. I wonder if we're on the verge of having the same sort of non-talk about ethnic problems and a resentment of immigrants. I was in the grocery store about a month ago, and the lines were pretty long, and I heard a disturbance in the line next to me, and then a elderly woman, very nicely dressed with a southern accent, came up behind me, and she had left the other line. And she said, "Oh, I just can't stand those foreigners. I wanted to be with an American. I wanted to have an American do my order." And I looked up, and there was a black woman who was going to wait on her. So this white southern woman would prefer a black woman to the woman that she had left, who was Latina. So she didn't want this foreign person. She wanted a fellow American who happened to be black. So maybe some Southern attitudes are changing. But it is that we haven't had much of a conversation about what our attitudes are. And immigrants are invisible. In the state, we tolerate a lot of illegal immigrants for positions that we really don't want to think about. We tolerate it because it serves our interest in many ways, but we don't want to think about it.
We tolerate it, and I suspect there has to be some economic benefit, or it probably wouldn't be happening. I mean, the state is – we're always talking about budget problems here and the economy – now, the problems it's having, clearly this economy looks good to some people.
Well, this is one of the great tensions in the Republican Party, that you have an anti-immigration or at least law and order voice. But, you know, look at the Wall Street Journal editorial page. They're not anti-immigration. There's huge economic benefit in agriculture and other industries. And going to Mike's point, if you go along High Point Road here in Greensboro, they're not an invisible population at all. And south of here in Asheboro, it is changing the culture and the daily life rapidly because the influx is so high. I mean, I grew up in Greensboro, and it was pretty much a black and white town. And now it is so much more diverse. And in areas like, say, Asheboro, where diversity was even further from people's minds, it is very much front of mind.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about all of the headlines about outsourcing and offshoring that has hurt the state, insourcing, which is something the Wall Street Journal talks about all the time, is something that seems to be to benefit the state. Certainly at the national level, they're talking about almost 5.5 million jobs that are created in the United States. I don't know if anybody has a figure for what's going on in North Carolina. Do we know the impact on the economy?
I think it is hard to say. The point that Laura made was interesting about how many of the immigrants, legal and otherwise, live in poverty. They didn't come here because they thought they were going to live in poverty. In many cases, they're much better off than they were in Mexico. But since they're somewhat better off, they're in a position, if they're illegal, of virtual slavery. If they work for agricultural firms, or even if they work for restaurants, there's the threat that you could just call La Migra.
Yeah, I saw an interesting statistic. I think you talked about 50% living near the poverty level, but the figure I saw for North Carolina was that 20% are at or below the poverty level, which is to say that 80% of immigrants into this state live at or above the poverty level. Well, I don't know how that compares to the population at large. But
it's important to remember also that the poverty level is $18,000 for a family of four. So, I mean, it's not exactly a living wage. But I think, looking at poverty statistics, rural Hispanics, rural Latinos are the most likely to be living at or under the poverty line. And a lot of that, of course, is agricultural. And I think Mike has a good point that most of them didn't think they'd be coming here to live in poverty. And it may be better than it was in Mexico. But when you look at relative definitions of poverty and what the state needs to do for people who live in it, that becomes a very hot political button. Now, we saw this trotted out a lot, I think, nationally and on a state level in the last political elections. And it's not going to go away anytime soon.
Well, let's talk about the other direction for globalization, and that is outsourcing. We've talked about it tangentially. North Carolina industries are feeling the impact, certainly, and in information technology as well, in those sectors. Outsourcing is not now confined to blue-collar jobs. We're seeing a lot of white-collar jobs leaving the state and the country, and I wonder if anything, Laura, is being done in the legislature to address that, outsourcing of white-collar work.
To be honest, there's not much they can do in the legislature. This really is a federal issue. And the governor has done a whole lot of correspondence with federal trade officials and with the Bush administration trying to get them to crack down on some of the trade policies that are in place. But, I mean, really, honestly, despite what you may have heard in the gubernatorial campaign, there's really not a whole lot that the governor can do about it. It's really got to come from Washington.
877-962-9862, the number to call if you want to join our conversation. Toby's on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Toby.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Hey, I wanted to tell you about Rural Sourcing. It's a company I work for. We basically set up development centers in the rural areas, and we bring in IT work, software work from around the country and hire people in rural areas to do the work. What else can I tell you about it?
I think that's plenty. Thanks, Toby. 877-962-9862. We almost became commercial radio there for a minute. How did we do that? Let's talk a little bit more about the white-collar outsourcing and offshoring. It becomes an interesting question, it seems to me, because right now we're talking about sending jobs to particularly places like India and China. It won't be long before those two countries have their own well-developed high-tech industries.
Actually, they really do. I mean, it's already beginning. But I think it's interesting that we talk about offshoring white-collar jobs and sending these jobs out, but at the same time, we're increasing our visa limits to bring in skilled workers so that we can do the things that we need to do here in this country. So, you know, I don't know whether this is a problem with distribution of resources or, you know, what the problem is, but it is interesting that it's not all one way, which is sometimes how we see it sort of given to us.
Well, there's a story in this morning's New York Times about or maybe it was the Wall Street Journal. It was some serious doom and gloom publication saying that U.S. students were doing worse than ever in math and science. So we need to import the talent, too, because apparently our kids are not learning this stuff.
Well, but as you suggest, Laura, the number of visas now is going up, but it's still not as high as it was in the pre-9/11
No.
years.
Well, in 2003 is when it took what we're talking about are called H-1B visas, which are guest worker visas, which are usually used in high-tech, academia, and some other industries. But there were almost 200,000 of those available as before October in 2003, and they cut that to 65,000. And so now they're boosting it back up to 85,000 when the president actually signs it, which he will. But still, it's much less than it used to be.
Fewer people coming in, and that has created a few problems in education institutions. Mike, I'm sure you're seeing it.
Yeah, we have to deal with that a lot.
And has it hurt?
Well, it makes it much more difficult for us to get graduate students in. It makes it harder for us to get guest faculty. It's basically impossible. It takes 6 or 8 months. I wonder about some of the job loss statistics I've tried to figure up. I think I've lost 1,200 pounds, but I gained about 1,400, and so I weigh 200 pounds.
This is lifetime.
Well, but so you talk about jobs that are lost. The fact is people are moving here from all over the world because we are a wealth creation machine, the likes of which the world has never seen before. So we've benefited from this trade regime. We're going through a rough patch now, but I guess I'm more optimistic than a lot of other people that I hear about the long-term prospects for free trade.
Well, the only problem is that people don't live long-term. People live in human lives. And so the evolution of, say, the textile industry from being in Flanders to England to New England to North Carolina to Mexico and China is no doubt of great interest to economists and no doubt a wonderful thing. But if you are 50 years old and looking to pay your bills for the next 20 years, that engine of wealth creation may seem a bit impersonal and set to grind you up.
So the question is, should we blame the Chinese and try to make things more expensive at Walmart, or should we try to improve our educational system so that we'll be ready for the next wave of buggy whips or textiles or high-tech or whatever comes next?
I vote for the second one.
Okay.
That's pretty good. But, Mike, you did suggest that all the statistics and all the reporting itself can have a kind of distorted or give us a distorted view of the world we live in, and that brings us to the topic of new media and blogs and et cetera. The internet, high-tech information. Got more. We've got new magazines, radio, satellite radio, information on the internet. And I'm wondering if, Mike, if you think that leaves us better informed or less well-informed.
There's a very disturbing study that was done for, and I don't mean to pick on Rush Limbaugh, but it happened to be for...
Go ahead. Just come to the right place.
listeners of Rush Limbaugh, they did a survey and asked them how well-informed they were on various topics. And then they also had a control group, people that didn't listen very much to Rush Limbaugh. And then they asked another question, that was, how much do you listen to Rush Limbaugh? And it turned out that the people who were big Rush Limbaugh listeners considered themselves to be extremely well-informed about politics. But objectively, if you give them basic civics test sorts of questions, they knew far less than the average person because there's this closed loop of information. So the problem with the proliferation of information sources is there's a lot more information out there, but it's also possible to have a boutique approach, right, where you only listen to people you already agree with. And it's entirely possible that this will spin off to disaster with people knowing too little to be able to make democratic decisions.
What do you think, Ed?
Well, I'm not so sure that the old model was working so well that I see the new model as being a disaster compared to it. I do think that the echo chamber is a danger, but I think it's not just a question of getting a new way of getting mass information out there. I think micro information and small audiences are a really interesting place that will have more information and better information. And so your local paper, your local TV station is not going to cover your kid's youth soccer game, but you might, and that might be of interest to a few people. I guess the corollary to Andy Warhol's "Everybody in the future will be famous for 15 minutes" is that on the web, everybody will be famous for 15 people.
right.
I stole that from Doc Searles, by the way, former Chapel Hill guy.
Ed, there's a new development in the local blog scene up in Greensboro, greensboro101.com. What is that?
Well, I'm very excited about it. My friend Rock Smith Jr. has put it together. It is an aggregator. What it does is it takes feeds from all the local blogs that have that are syndicating their content. I'm trying to put this in English, and I apologize. It takes all the local blogs and posts headlines from them. It's sort of a table of content for local blogging, and it's dynamic. Every time you put something new on your blog, it shows up at greensboro101.com. Mm. And what it does is it begins to establish a central node on the network, not the only portal on the network, but a place where you can go and you can say, all right, Greensboro has all these interesting local weblogs and all these local voices talking about what they care about and what they know about. Is there a central place I can go to find what's new and to learn about new blogs and see their new information? And now there is. The News and Record is very blog-friendly, our daily monopoly paper here. And they, I think you can count on them getting into some sort of local portal business, too. I got a whole rap about this and the long tail and web economic theory, but I won't bore you with it.
Just... Well, but it does suggest that it's a possible solution to Mike's problem, which is the boutiquing or the channeling of our information and our searches. If we end up with a place like Greensboro 101, we're then at least presented with a little variety, although we can click whatever we want.
But I could choose... If I, as a web surfer, I could say, forget all that stuff. I'm just going to go to Mungowitz End, my Munger's blog, and get my daily dose of vitriol and fabrication. That's all I need. You know, or I could go to edcohn.com and get the truth, whatever. But I could just get one site. So it doesn't solve the problem. It offers a solution to the problem.
I was actually working in, I just moved here from California not too long ago and was covering the recall when a big issue hit the Sacramento Bee, which is another fine McClatchy publication like our local Raleigh News and Observer. But Daniel Weintraub, who was one of their head political columnists, wanted to do a blog. And at that point, nobody was really doing blogs, as columnists, I think, you know, as part of the paper. And there was a lot of editorial sort of pushback on it. People were, the editors were unsure because it's like, well, is this news or is this your opinion or is this a column or is this a blog? How do you define this content? And should the paper be having some measure of editorial control over that? And there was a big fight within the paper about what's a, is a blog news?
Well, how do you deal with that, Ed?
Well, I'm not an employee of the News and Record. They pay me and give me a nice spot on their Sunday editorial page, op-ed page. But I have not had to cross that bridge with them. However, their editor-in-chief is blogging, John Robinson, and they allow several of their reporters to write weblogs under their own rubric, under the News and Records rubric. So those are understood to be News and Record product. The really hard part comes when an individual wants to write their own weblog. And this is going to be a hot issue for newspapers and other publications for years to come. My guess is you cannot keep them down on the farm after they've seen Perry. You can't let people taste the freedom of writing a weblog and then rein them in.
No, but it does present an interesting problem because professionally you learn how to rein in your opinions and your ideas and present things in a balanced way. If you break down the wall by writing this blog, and especially if you get a good response, strikes me it might spill over into your other work.
Well, I hope so. I only hope so. I mean, I'm a professional, and when I, you know, what does objectivity mean? That's another four or five shows. But, you know, I write tech and business stories. If I have a personal political view about Microsoft, objectivity means that I cover Microsoft as a business story without letting my personal views color it. But the idea that I can't then go home and write on my weblog that Windows is awful is ridiculous.
Well, our objective reality now is that we are about 30 seconds from the end of this segment, so I'm going to have to say goodbye. We've been talking with Mike Munger, chair of the Political Science Department. Ed Cohn is opinion columnist for the Greensboro News and Record, and WUNC's Capitol reporter, Laura Leslie. Thank you all.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
Coming up, musician Ani DeFranco knuckles down and hits the road. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow.
I said Venice, and you heard Vegas. Now I say either way, baby, let's go. Oh, I get so shaky, and I just can't shake it. Oh, a place like this, I'm one of those.
Singer-songwriter Ani DeFranco recorded her last album in solitude. That album was called Educated Guess, and on it you can hear the banging of screen doors and the sawing of cicadas outside her home in Buffalo. Her new album is different. Knuckle Down is Ani DeFranco's 22nd release in 15 years, and like much of her earlier work, it was conceived and recorded far from home, on the road, and in collaboration with other musicians. Ani DeFranco performs tonight in concert in Raleigh. Ani, welcome.
Hey, Frank.
Your next album comes out in January, and it's called Knuckle Down. Is this an album about a change in direction?
Yes, I suppose, although they might all be, since I've been spinning like a top since I began writing. But I've spent a few years alone now and reflecting and doing a lot of changing, trying to, you know, stop repeating old patterns and come up with some new songs, new subjects.
Certainly in the way it was produced, this album is different from your last album. Mm-hmm. You talked about coming from a more solitary place to a more collaborative one. You're working with a band for the first time in a long time.
Yeah. After making that Educated Guess record at home alone, it was high time to leave the house and make record music with people again. So I did something I've never done, which is, well, ship off to L.A. I went to La La Land and made a record with a bunch of folks I don't really know. So it was a whole kind of divine collaboration that was many months in the scheming and then just a few days in the manifesting.
Was it divine? I can think that that transition might be a pretty tough one to make.
Yeah. Well, divine in a very difficult way, as you know, any sort of challenging endeavor is.
But it is interesting because nobody can accuse you of not, you know, again, the suggestion in Knuckle Down is that you haven't been working hard enough, but there's a lot of hard work reflected in all, and originality in all the work. So, you know, you kind of wonder where this epiphany, what this moment was that you turned around and said to yourself, hey, girl, get to work.
Well, I guess, you know, it's a different kind of work. Yeah. You know, it's like when you finally, you know, accept some work that you should be doing that you're not, you know.
And what is that?
Well, I suppose it's personal in nature and, you know, yeah, it's sort of there in the songs, you know. It's hard when you're a writer and you spend so much time working on exactly what you have to say, and you write these tunes, and then you're supposed to say what they say,
<That's right. laughs>
explain it in a moment.
I wrote this good song. Why don't you go listen to it?
Yeah.
Let's. Well, why don't we listen? Why don't we do just that? Why don't we listen to something? Your songs are obviously very personal, and they reach people in a very deep and personal way. And then, as you suggested, even in our discussion, it's hard to talk about these things. That's what the art is all about. And I wonder if it's difficult for an artist, if that puts pressure on you, because you reach people in such a personal and intimate way, if it puts pressure on you to stay the same, if it makes it difficult for you to change direction.
I suppose sure it does, but I don't listen to that pressure or pay attention to it. There's all kinds of other much more useful pressures than you know, honey, fit my stereotype of you and do what I need you to do always. Don't change. So it's much, you know, I mean, I think that those pressures are only as potent as we allow them to be, you know. So for me, it's always much more compelling to follow my muse. And sometimes down blind alleys, you know, I'm not doing the most effective or successful thing with my art all the time, because that's not really my priority, you know. It's much more about discovery. So I think that's just the prerequisite for me in art.
You talked about some useful pressures. What are they?
To be true, to be in the moment, to be brave, you know, to really say what you feel, even if, you know, it's maybe not going to go down so easily, or, you know, this kind of thing. Be who you are on stage, even if that is a person who's struggling that night, or a person who's, whatever the energy is, you know, to use it and to be true to it, that kind of thing.
Your latest album has songs about other people in your life, your family as well. One song from the album is Studying Stones.
Using all of my will to keep very still, still even on.
my eyes can't make their connection. I am holding my breath, I am feigning my death when I'm looking in your direction. Of course, mom is an old hat. Oldest, my oldest memories. See, that one's my mother, and that one's my father, and that one in the hat, that's me. It's a skill I'd hope to abandon when I got out on the open road. But any more pent up emotion,
the image of the old hat in that song. Now we've talked about this before. I know you don't want to go much beyond what the song is talking about, but it's a powerful image, and it isn't clear to me what that means. And can you tell us about it?
Well, you know, I just love becoming intimate with a language. You know, the only one I am is English, and the, you know, personality of the language, you know, in terms of expressions. And this expression, old hat, you know, we all know what that means. It's like old news for somebody. But I was also just using it as a literal image, you know, and the chorus of the song, you know, numb is an old hat. Mm. Old is my oldest memories. See, that one's my mother and that one's my father and the one in the hat, that's me. You know, it's like a behavior I learned early on to go numb when I'm really hurting and just kind of ride out pain that way.
You mentioned your father, and I'm very sorry to hear about your father. You lost your father recently.
Yeah, thanks.
The song Recoil mentions him and uses another phrase like that. I think you refer to him as time traveling.
Mm, yeah. Well, that last song is very, very dear to my heart because it's, you know, it's me and my father are in it together, that tune. And I wrote it before he passed, of course. And, you know, the last few years of his life, he was suffering from dementia, as they call it. And, you know, it's funny. People in my family were kind of worked up that he was confused, that, you know, were upset that he was confusing things and time and space. But I always felt that he was not very confused at all, that that time traveling made a lot of sense when you were in a nursing home and you were stuck without a lot to do all day, and that, you know, you could live all kinds of lives sitting there in a wheelchair if you were creative enough. And so I watched my father do that and meanwhile remain very lucid emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes he would call me the wrong name or something, or get me and my mother confused, but he always knew what was going on. He always knew how he felt and I felt, and there was always a trueness to our interactions.
Yeah, I suppose it's risky to romanticize this kind of thing, but there is a certain poetic quality. And I have an aunt who has Alzheimer's, and we spoke for 90 minutes to 2 hours, uninterrupted. We were alone together, and it suddenly occurred to me that not a single sensible word passed between us. And yet, it was a conversation that was uninterrupted, because emotionally, we were in complete contact. Everything about her tone and gesture suggested that she knew, in some sense of the word, who I was. And but there was not a sensible, coherent sentence.
Right.
You know, that's what poetry does. You sort of take words out of their place and out of time, and then you create two and three and four images all at once.
Yes, I agree with you wholeheartedly. There is always a poetry to the way we remember and the way we forget.
Mm.
Yes.
Spoken word is also an important part of your. You use the spoken word, and most of your CDs, if not all, include a dry track, a track without music, and in your performances as well.
Yes, I was a poetry fiend before I even started writing songs. As a little girl, I became enamored of poetry. You know, when a poet, an artist in residence, came into my public school, and she was a poet, and I was thrilled by this idea of, like, distilling language, and when I learned what a metaphor was and this kind of thing.
When you write, are there poems that require music and others that couldn't be put to music, or is it somewhat arbitrary?
Well, I think I just follow my instincts, you know. I'm very intuitive with my work, and looking back over what pieces of writing sort of gelled in a more more as poetry and mm-hmm. others as songs, I think that there are certain things that for me are inherently easier to sing, and certain things that are easier to say. I've been struggling with writing very specific, like pointed political writing mm-hmm. these days, and making it songs. it's hard to say multinational corporation or yeah. patriarchy in a song, and have it kind of sing. I've been finding that a lot of my political, quote unquote, writing these days is sort of stays as poetry, because there is a more of a freeness to mm-hmm. the verse that way.
When you write political stuff, do you find yourself artistically in a different place than when you write the more personal songs that you write?
No, because whatever kind of reflections are bouncing around in a song, they're all personally. It's mm-hmm. when I take a macro political situation very personally, that's when I write a song about it. But, when I am writing about love or emotions, the writing does seem to flow more, like the emotion mm. does. If I'm trying to speak to a specific political circumstance, I find I do a lot more wrestling, a lot more reworking.
You certainly had a reputation early in your career as an angry young woman. That seems to have gone out of the music, not the passion, but some of the anger. Have you felt that?
Wow.
And is the writing different for you? Do you approach it any differently?
No, not at all. I think the anger is all still there, along with all of the other emotions that were always there. I think the anger has gone out of the people listening to, describing, and defining me.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty much doing the same thing in a different way, and not as an 18-year-old anymore, as a 34-year-old, but I am the same spirit and the same, with the same intention, of course. So I have found, though, that after years of being out there doing my thing, I've sort of outlived certain stereotypes, like that angry woman thing, which anyone who knows me always found to be quite ironic.
So you don't think that was a good characterization ever, the angry?
Well, exactly.
So, but you talk about getting older, and you're getting older in my hometown of Buffalo, New York, and you're settling down. Even to you're doing gardening. I mean, have you just discovered gardening, or
have
you always been interested?
Yeah. I mean, I have my own place now and my own garden, so I can put my hands in the dirt when I get home off tour. I mean, that's not very often, so. Settling down isn't...
It's good you're doing it in Buffalo, because you can only do it 3 weeks
exactly,
out of the year.
Exactly, I know.
I get to say that.
Yeah, but I do find in for those months that my garden is awake and those moments that I'm at home to be with it, it's an incredible antidote for a life such as mine.
Ani, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ani DeFranco's new album comes out next month. It's called Knuckle Down. And she performs tonight with political songwriter and singer Dan Byrne at the Disco Rodeo in Raleigh. And for today, that's the state of things. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment, you can drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Frank Stachow.
Come home and my guitar has nothing to say to me. I recoil from all my friends, and then I'm in misery. Been so long since I've been here, really since I was his. Probably just need to be here.